Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is newly arrived breast surgeon, Dr. Karen Barbosa. She's been here since May and joined the Alaska Institute for Surgical and Medical Specialties here in Anchorage. She did her fellowship training in surgery and breast surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. Our discussion today is going to focus really on the surgical treatment of breast disorders, both benign and malignant. We'll touch on some cosmetic issues as well. If you've got questions or comments about anything you hear today, please feel free to take the time to give us a call. Here's how you can reach us with a phone call, 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. As usual, we also have a toll-free number. Well, that's 1-888-353-5752. And also during the next 55 minutes or so, you can reach us by email at line1, spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Barbosa, it's a pleasure to meet you, to have you join us on Line 1, and to welcome you to the medical community.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a wonderful pleasure to be able to talk to people and give them some good information that they can become empowered to take care of themselves.
Good. I often start with the basics, so I'm going to start with kind of the basics here. Although the breast is maybe not the most complex organ that humans have, tell us a little bit about the basic anatomy and physiology that'll help us understand what we're dealing with.
Well, it starts off with the glandular tissue. First, when we're going to look at the skin, when you look at the breast tissue, it has a nipple areolar complex, commonly known as something like a NAC. Nipple areola complex includes the areola and the nipple, which has about 15 ducts that converge, and all of the lobules and ducts in the breast all come to that. And of course, the purpose is for breastfeeding. So when we look at the skin, we then drop down and there's a small layer of fatty tissue, subcuticular fat, that lines right above the breast tissue, right below the skin. And that's the mastectomy plane that we want to get into. And then the ductal tissue is mixed with the lobular tissue as it cascades. Think of the roots of a tree, and it'll give you a pretty good visual.
Okay. And my understanding, at least from talking to women about checking your breast, your breast tissue, those lobules and ducts and everything are going up kind of like a tear duct up towards your axilla, your armpit?
Correct. I mean, think about it. All the roots are converging and getting larger and larger towards the nipple duct itself. And then underneath the breast tissue is a fascia, which is, you know, a more thick coating of tissue that then separates the breast tissue off of the muscle. And there's also a retro mammary fatty plane in there as well. So
okay. And that gets right down into your chest wall mm-hmm. after that. Okay. Next, I guess I would like to, well, I tell you what, let's ask about a breast program. You, before you came up here, you had run or started or developed a breast program back east in Long Island, I believe. What is meant by a breast program, and is that something that may be in the works up here?
Yeah, well, the thing is, every hospital, I think, in the next 5 years is going to have a dedicated breast surgeon and a breast program, which should encompass not only having a breast surgeon who's dedicated to just doing breast surgery, but also someone who is going to help with the medical oncology aspects should a patient have a breast cancer and need medical oncology, as well as radiation oncology. So basically what we're trying to do is put all of the needs of the patient in one location. So in addition to the radiation oncology, we have a social worker, which is helpful to navigate the waters. A nurse navigator is another position, someone to actually help them understand the terminology and the diagnosis. It's pretty overwhelming when you hear the diagnosis and realize, wait, I have to meet like four more doctors, and then a plastic surgeon should be available and on board. The geneticist is a valuable component to having that on board so that if a patient has any genetic risks, that they get properly counseled before surgery. You know, one of the problems is that sometimes people find out after surgery, and then it might have changed the patient's, you know, elected surgical procedure.
Okay. All right. So now let's jump ahead and let's say we've got the prototypical average. Here comes a woman almost certainly, but not always, perhaps, with a breast lesion or a breast problem or something that's been discovered. What's the sequence of events? You meet them, you do what, and then that's going to lead possibly to different kinds of diagnostic procedures. And if you kind of go through a list of those so we can understand each of those a little bit about what they do and what they can't do.
Well, every patient that walks in the door should get a full physical. And encompassing that, you want to look also at the age, because that's going to be a big shift on how you do imaging. So women who are young, your proper management is going to be if there's an abnormal palpable lesion or something that they're feeling in their breast. If they're, you know, less than 30, you're going to be doing an ultrasound. And if the woman is of mammographic age or 30 or has a family history, then you're probably going to get an ultrasound and a mammogram for part of the workup. But it really depends on what you're feeling. So a big part of it is the age to see which, you know, road you're going to go down in terms of imaging. But as well as that, the patient should be genetically evaluated, meaning that if they're over 35, I tend to offer them the evaluation on the breast risk tool model for their life risk of having breast cancer. And there's several different types of models. The one I commonly use is the Gale model, modified.
So the reason that you didn't mention mammogram in women less than 30 is the risk of cancer in that age group presenting with a new nodule is much less, I'm guessing.
No, actually. It's a great question to ask because that's what most people might think. And the reality is no. The reason I'm not advocating mammogram in a young woman is because the breast tissue, when you image it on mammogram, mm-hmm. is extremely dense.
Okay.
And so when I'm having my patients and I pull up their films and I show them their films and I'm talking to them, what I try to get them to understand is the more breast tissue and the more density you have, the whiter the film will appear.
Right.
So a young girl, if you image her, will look like a sheet of paper because it's so dense. So as a woman tends to age, the reason we look at mammograms later in life, you know, 40s and 50s, is because as we age, the dense breast tissue becomes replaced with fatty tissue. Good news, bad news is that's why the girls tend to sag a little bit. But with all that fatty tissue, the breast is actually much more easily evaluated on mammographic imaging.
Yep. Yep, I knew that, but I didn't think about it correctly. Betsy, you're on line one. You want to ask us a question about this?
Yes, actually, almost specifically what you're talking about. I recently found a lump, and I was given a mammogram, and they could feel it, but they couldn't see it. So they gave me an ultrasound, and they weren't conclusive with the ultrasound. And I'm 44, but I was told I have dense breast tissue.
Yes.
And he said that usually with people like me, they recommend MRIs, but that it's not practical.
I'm so glad you called. This is why I love doing stuff like this. What I'm going to say is, a lot of times what happens is there's a correlate between, you know, a young woman coming in, there's, you know, you feel something that's concerning and they do all the imaging, but everything looks really normal and they can't figure out what's going on. Sometimes it's as simple as putting it together. There is something called breast tissue step off. So depending on where in your anatomy, it might not be actually something that needs to be further pursued on MRI, but it might just be a question of, well, your breast tissue drops off into the axillary fat. So it's the contrast between the edge of the breast that is well defined and then the fatty axillary tissue. So sometimes it's the edge of the breast. Sometimes the patient has actually the anatomy of their particular makeup is a rib. And so it's rib that you're feeling, and it's completely normal. And so when you image, the mammogram looks normal, and the ultrasound looks normal, and it's really more the anatomy of the patient that just needs to be explained in conjunction with the analysis. A lot of times the ultrasounds are done by a tech. The radiologist reads it, and no one's actually putting hand to patient. And so a lot of times my docs will refer to me just because I'll try to bring it all together. Mm-hmm. So before you start going to an MRI, you might want to get seen by a breast surgeon just to make sure that you don't have one of those scenarios. That's the most commonly involved. That being said, there are cases where you have what's called mammographically occult disease, and it's not picked up on mammogram. Most of the time, those are then found on ultrasound. It is rare that you're actually going to need to go from no mammo findings, no ultrasound findings, right to MRI. And the reason I caution MRI is because there are a lot of false positives. So if you need it, It's a great test to have. If you don't need it, it can lead you to getting a biopsy that you don't need. It can also lead you to finding stuff that may be somewhat premature. And I don't know if it's, I could talk about so much stuff.
Yep.
Talking about the incidentalomas that we find, and now there's data coming from Europe in trials where cancers, the contained cancers, the DCISs, are being found on MRI that really wouldn't affect a patient's situation. So are we prematurely finding things on MRI that might not need to get treated? And that's all among our societies, we're all fighting about that, but we try to do it behind closed doors.
Well, I did. They actually, in the ultrasound, found not only that lump, but a couple of others.
Okay.
They just couldn't tell what they were. But what I'm wondering is, what do I do as a 44-year-old woman yearly? You know, if I'm not getting, if mammograms can't read my breast tissue, what do you recommend?
Well, once again, like I said, what I would recommend is getting evaluated on a Gale risk model, looking at your family history. And it's not just your family history. It's in conjunction with, have you had kids? When did you first start your menses? You know, have you ever had a breast biopsy? And it plugs in all this information and it spits out a little number. And at the end of it, you should be able to say, are you high risk, greater than 20% in your lifetime, or are you low risk? And it looks at your lifetime risk. And based on that, if you're 20 or greater on a Gale stratification, then there's probably a good support that maybe you should be getting MRI. But if you've got dense breasts, tomosynthesis has been very helpful, because what it does is it basically slices the breast up and into smaller pieces, so to speak. And so we can scroll up and down within the imaging to see if something is real or is it that breast tissue density. And a lot of times that's why for women who are listening and have had the breast compressions and they bring you back for a spot, that's what we're doing. We're trying to squash or efface the breast tissue. If it seems really dense, if it's a real mass or tumor, no matter how much pressure you put on it, it will not go away. A lot of times if you put pressure on it and it goes away or effaces, then it wasn't real. It was just tissue on top of tissue. So your situation is a little bit, you know, like there's some data that needs to be put into the equation, you know, not knowing what your physical exam is. I'm hesitant to caution you not to get an MRI, but I would say if you haven't seen someone, maybe go have someone put hand to you and make sure that there are a lot of benign things that can live in the breast and present as lumps. I often tell my patients, you know, we're not made by Mattel. Barbie's nice and smooth and symmetric. We're not. So when you feel your breasts, there are people who are going to be lumpy, bumpy. And I've done exam on women that have what I call the bag of marbles breast. And as we age, that becomes less and less prominent and it becomes more subtle. And then I have women that I examine and I always refer to their breasts as the oatmeal that you find where the store or the institution has put so much milk in it, it's very soupy. And that's a very easy breast to evaluate because all of those lumps aren't prominent. So the one thing that's really important is if all those lumps feel mobile and smooth and feel similar to each other, and then check the other breast. Do you have similar type of lumps and bumps?
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is with Betsy, who's 44, the answer to, one, how do I pursue this, finding out exactly what I'm feeling now, with an MRI or other procedure, really depends somewhat on what it feels like, the expertise they're feeling, and then also the risk factors that would drive a little bit more thorough evaluation.
Yeah.
And that's for somebody her age. It's not so each individual person, this is something that
I think is extremely important.
It's
the fingerprint of the patient that determines what we do.
It's not the overall guidelines.
Cutter. Yeah. You know, I love academia. God bless them for the research. But the one problem is that everyone follows these nomograms. And sometimes people, you know, there's so many arms or legs to where you can go down the flow chart that people don't remember that you've got to take into account the patients themselves. And there are several factors or variables that, you know, when you start doing this over and over again, I tend to put in my head. And I don't know that I could articulate them all, but you look at the habitus. You know, is the patient overweight? That actually leads to a higher risk of breast cancer. Does the family history contribute anything? Does the patient's age contribute anything in terms of higher risk? Women can get breast cancer at a younger age. So it's really something that you should automatically know that it's an you know, not necessarily so that young women don't get it. So if in doubt, check it out. That's my mantra.
And then her other question was, what about follow-up from here? And then I think the answer still, in my mind, is it just depends. Well, how, what's going on this
next
year?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard
to
counsel.
Once you hit 50, it's going to be maybe a different.
Right.
And the technology is going to be evolving over time.
Well, and it's changing all the time.
Right.
And it's getting better and better. And we're looking at more.
Right.
So the tomosynthesis is great for young, dense breasts. It's a little bit more exposure in the radiation. But the bang for the buck is that you are actually getting to see better what is, you know, more breast tissue on breast tissue and really not something that needs to be biopsied. So there are people who would advocate, and once again, the trouble with research is you could probably find a study going in either direction.
Right.
But the majority of what I've been hearing from my colleagues in the Department of Radiology is that they feel that Tomo is actually decreasing the number of unnecessary biopsies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what was intended to do. So I think for, you know, for this patient, what I would recommend is making sure she has someone put a hand on it, put it in conjunction with doing a Gale risk on her and putting it all together in a bow, because you don't want to say someone's okay and then hope without actually seeing them. It's very tailored.
And then yearly or every so often, she has to go through this decision again. And
that's why the Gale risk is really important. If you're 35 years of age or older, we do have tools that have been vetted that we can look at you. I mean, if you have a very strong family history, there are other, you know, risk models that we can use. But for a patient who doesn't really have a very strong history, the Gale is very quick and simple. We can get a guesstimation. Mm-hmm. If someone's 35 or older, they should get that evaluation. And, you know, I've been trying to institute that at my clinic because a high-risk protocol is really important. And like I said, this patient here, if she's got a low risk, probably doesn't benefit from an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's high risk, she probably would benefit from an MRI.
Okay.
So there's a lot of importance to finding out what someone brings to the table in that regard.
We confuse you pretty well, Betsy.
No, I've put a lot of thought into this and talked to quite a few people about it, so I really appreciate your input on it.
All right. What other question that comes to my mind, if you don't mind us picking on you a little bit, is, so what's the recommendation for the next follow-up? Yearly at 44 with these findings? More often? Less often? And again, I know it's going to depend in general on a lot more factors.
Right. So let's say she's not high risk.
Right.
And, you know, now she's telling us that the radiologist is recommending MRI. So let's assume she goes down the MRI trail and the MRI shows nothing. And hopefully she doesn't have a false positive and she doesn't need to do a biopsy. Then she's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's been benedicted. Everything's good. And she should probably get dropped back to, you know, yearly screening. If she goes down the MRI scale and she has now a situation where she needs a biopsy, that could open another can of worms to be addressed at that time. But let's say she's high risk. Well, I wouldn't recommend she go back to a yearly exam. If she's high risk, then what I would suggest is that she might want to look at staggering mammogram yearly with an MRI 6 months out from that mammogram so that she has some form of diagnostic evaluation throughout that year. Some institutions do it all at once. I find that it leaves a bald spot. You know, you're looking at someone intensely for a year, and then you're just letting them go. So what I recommend is the mammogram once a year, 6 months after the mammogram, doing an MRI. And if she's high risk, there has been a benefit to doing that, especially if she's got dense breasts.
Okay. All right. This raises another question in my mind. Let's stay on the same tack for right now. The reason for all of this discussion, debate, decision trees, guidelines, and everything is not to miss something.
Correct.
That's important. And we're talking about cancer. So what's the natural history of a new cancer? I want to have people hear, how long are cancers there? How long does it take for them to get really important? How long does it take them to get diagnosed, recognized? Okay. And I know part of the answer is going to be, well, it depends again. But
Yeah. So now I sound like a radiologist. I'll hedge my bets. Could be this, could be that. Suggest further correlation with clinical analysis.
Right.
But that being said, seriously, one of the best parts about this question is it presents us with an opportunity for women to understand that the minute they have been diagnosed with a cancer, it didn't show up the week before or the month before. It has been growing growing in your breast anywhere from 3 to 5 years. Okay. If you've got a more advanced or more aggressive, the duplication and replication rate can be much quicker. So it can present itself quickly over 6 months or, you know, even 3 months, depending on when you find it relative to the division and replication rate of the tumor itself. But for the most part, the more likely scenario is that it's been in a woman's breast anywhere from 3 to 7 to even 10 years in the elderly patient with the more indolent, slower growing tumors. That being said, there's a wonderful study by Michael Dixon, how women with whatever, for whatever reason, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And 75% of those women with a biopsy-proven diagnosis of breast cancer didn't get treated. And it was, you know, possibly because they couldn't get to the hospital. Some of them might have been financial. Some of them could have been not given the follow-up word that they actually had cancer. So for whatever reason, these women were evaluated and they had the diagnosis of breast cancer and didn't get treated. The data on these women showed that 75% had no change in their overall prognosis or outcome if they had gotten treated before 9 months. So 9 months is a long time to have a positive diagnosis and not have a bad outcome. So one of the things that I always tell my patients is about this study, because it really gives them a little bit better perspective that they shouldn't make a rash decision. And I often find people doing fear factor decision-making options, you know, get them off, and they don't understand what they're doing or why they're doing it. They're just so afraid of having cancer in their body.
Okay. All right. So the lesson is here is that we're learning as we understand cancers better, as they're all different.
Yes.
Just like Dr. Barbosa and myself. Some of us are taller, some of us are not, some of us are faster growing, some of them are not. That's one of the issues. But in general, these take a long time
to
develop.
For the most part, yes.
For the most part.
Younger women tend to have the more aggressive variant. And
Which makes some sense. And can progress much more
quickly. Right. Once again, what I try to get people to also understand is it's a disease of aging. Mm-hmm. If you have a young woman with breast cancer, that's a bit abnormal, and you should definitely double check and look at things twice. So if something doesn't add up, have a low threshold for suspicion and be quite active. I mean, no one's going to get upset if you put them through the hoops and nothing pans out, but they will get upset if you don't do your due diligence and you've missed something.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I would think of, just to, again, stay on this line, again, is somebody comes into me and as a breast surgeon or somebody, and it was 20 with a breast cancer, just like we talked about bowel cancer or colon cancer last week, it raised my ears about other, why are we seeing it that early? Is there some genetic predisposition? Particularly, there may be other environmental issues, but particularly in genetics.
For the most part, whenever we see a young woman, that is a red flag, and you should be thinking genetic predisposition. All the press in the papers about the BRCA1 and BRCA2 has been good and bad. It makes awareness, but the trouble is then women all think that it's got to be genetic, and then the converse of that is a lot of women will turn around and say, well, I have no family history, and I'm fine, and that's not the case. The majority of breast cancers are spontaneous. And so it's really important to realize that anywhere from 15% to less than 10% are going to be the genetic variants or mutations. The majority, about 90%, are actually going to be in a no history patient. So it's important to understand that if you get it young, below the age of 50, you really do want to have a high index of suspicion for a genetic and see a genetic counselor and or get tested. Talk to someone.
All right. This is one of these days where things seem to be going at light speed. We're already at our mid-program break. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Let me go ahead and give our numbers again, however, because we're going to be gone for just a minute or so, and then we'll be back. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So after a very short break of about a minute, we'll return to our discussion with Dr. Karen Barbosa. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm trying to catch my breath. We've been moving so fast here. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing surgical disorders of the breast with a breast surgeon named Karen Barbosa. Karen has just joined the community in May and has been a great addition. She practices at the Alaska Institute of Surgical and Medical Specialties here in Anchorage. If you've got questions about what you hear today, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can call us on a toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And also you can go to alaskapublic.org where you'll find our archives and our website. We have talked primarily, Dr. Barbosa, about cancer so far, and I have no problem with getting back to it, but I want to start this segment of the program on benign lesions, and I'll let you kind of discuss that in the way you think is important, so things that women may feel or have happened to their breasts that are not of so much concern, but I also want to make sure we talk about breast augmentation and then de-augmentation, taking away breast tissue for women who have uncomfortably large breasts. And just so I'll let you take it from here, and then we'll see where the program goes.
Okay. So starting off, it's a great thing to discuss is that the majority of things in a woman's breast that you're going to find or feel like this is abnormal and get you scared before you even come into the office are benign. And what most commonly they are things called cysts, which are water-filled balloons. That's how I explain them to patients that have a live cell lining. So these little water balloons or water sacs in the breast, the cysts, are benign. And there are rare cases where they can be cystic cancers, but really it's the outlier, not the standard of care. So everything that you think is concerning should be worked up. Don't assume that it's a cyst without going to a doctor, getting imaging, or getting it evaluated. The other thing that's very commonly found in the breast tissue that is benign and has women running to the doctor's office is something called a fibroadenoma. It's very dense glandular tissue. When you feel it, it's rubbery, it's soft, it's mobile. When you feel the edges of it, it feels like someone kind of smuggled a Super Bowl or a little grape underneath your breast. The symmetry of when you roll your fingers over it almost defines itself. And once again, you shouldn't be the one diagnosing yourself with a fibroadenoma. We need to confirm it with imaging. And ultrasound happens to be the best to decide which is it. Is it a cyst filled with fluid under tension and it feels hard? Or is it really a fibroadenoma, which is the dense breast tissue? The important thing about that is that these benign things can be palpable and can cause a lot of concern. So what happens is women are coming in because of this, then a lot of times they're recommended, take it out or to do a biopsy. If it's a cyst or a fibroadenoma and looks normal and benign on imaging, the standard of care is to call it a BI-RADS 3, which is follow it up in 6 months just to document that it hasn't changed. You don't always need to do a biopsy. So when do you do a biopsy on these things? When they look atypical. If the cyst has an enhancement, that's atypical. That might be something suspicious. If it has mixed densities, if it has a solid component. A fibroadenoma, same thing. If it respects the plane of the breast and it grows right to left or medial to lateral, what we say is that it's most likely a benign procedure. It's growing in the right direction. If it's vertical growth in the breast, that's more ominous. So there are a lot of things that we can see just on ultrasound to really nail it. And the nice thing about a BI-RADS 3, which is doctor talk for, it's a 98% security that it is absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, we can watch it and just make sure it's a duck. There are consequences to doing biopsies. And if you don't need it, don't do it. I've taken women to the OR for post-procedural hemorrhaging, mm-hmm. and they've actually had blood clots in there. And I took one woman who actually bled underneath her skin and actually lifted her whole breast off due to post-procedural bleeding. So I'm very gingerly about who should get it, who doesn't get it. I've had patients come in for a second opinion just on that alone.
What about augmentation, breast implants? What can we say about that?
Well, the technology has gotten so much better in terms of the quality of implants. Most people have the option of either getting saline and or going with the silicone. And so silicone had a bad rap and was taken off the market for many years and actually reintroduced. And now we have these implants that are made of silicone and that are like gummies. And that is where you can actually cut the implant with a knife. And it won't bleed. The old thing used to be a balloon, so to speak, of silicone. And in the first studies of doing breast augmentation, there were people who were actually just injecting straight silicone into the breast. And I've actually, unfortunately, had the misfortune of seeing a couple of those patients where they just injected free silicone. The trouble with that is it goes everywhere and it settles throughout the body. So that is obviously no longer on the table. The newer implants are safe. We do, however, recommend that you go for putting it behind the muscle. So that's a subpectoral as opposed to subglandular. Subglandular meaning it goes behind the breast tissue. It sits above the muscle. So when you go to get your imaging, it's much more difficult to assess the breast tissue because we can't really push it or distract it back out of the view.
All right. And one more question and I'll get off of this and we'll take a couple of phone calls and we have some emails. What about the woman, particularly the young woman who has very large breasts, very uncomfortable, and wants to take some of that tissue off? What's the risk that this is going to affect subsequent breastfeeding is my specific question, because I see women who've had this done in the past and have had problems breastfeeding. Is that as big a worry now?
In this day and age, it shouldn't be a problem. And a lot of that speaks to, you know, once again, you do have a patient who is an outlier who's going to fibrose or scar. The more you manipulate the tissue, the more problematic it is. And I would tend to say that we've learned our lessons from the years gone by. If it doesn't need to be messed with, don't do it, because you can create scar tissue. And that can cause all of the difficulties with, you know, breastfeeding and, you know, severing these ducts. So what I recommend is at this point, make sure that you go to a doctor who's had a good experience doing a reduction and pregame it, so to speak. Go in there and tell them, I haven't had kids. I'm looking to breastfeed. And at least the doctor is teed up to know I'm not going to be as aggressive with moving tissue, or I'm going to leave a heartier pillar, which is basically the blood supply to the nipple, and try to minimize the amount of dissection.
Okie doke. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wow. All right, Ken, you are on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, Dr. Woodard. The timing of this is extraordinary. I'm sitting in my car, and I had the radio come on, and here was your show, which, by the way, I always love. And my wife is scheduled for a biopsy now. She has a history of benign cysts in different parts of her body, including one that has been in her breast for a number of years. She had a mammogram recently, and they discovered one or two more what appear to be cysts. And they want her to come in and have a biopsy on this, and we're both fairly stressed out about this. And I'm wondering, is this the proper sequence? Should we get a second opinion? Is there another step in between, particularly taking into account that she has not had, she has had this history of cysts, and she's had a few of them taken out, and they're benign. They've always been benign.
All right. I'm going to ask Dr. Barbosa to answer your question. She's probably going to ask you some very specific, maybe a couple more specific general questions, but specific about age and risk and so forth. But before we do that,
you're a quick pickup. You've got a job. Want to come over?
I've been here a while. But what I want to make sure is that everybody understands, and I think you will understand this, is it's very difficult to make an exact recommendation by on the radio like this. But we're here to try to give you as much information and make the best decision as you can. So here's Dr. Barbosa.
Okay, so first off, like he said, we need to find out what's the age. How old is your wife?
She's 50. Gosh, I hope she doesn't hear me.
I forgot about that.
Mostly,
next time you call in, make sure you say, I have a friend. I don't know why, this poor guy, you're driving, you better pull over and go get some flowers. Sorry, buddy. Oh, I set this guy up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say 54.
Okay.
54.
All right. So the other thing is, does she have a strong family history of breast cancer?
No, none at all.
Any family history of ovarian cancer?
No.
On her father's side as well. Just remember, there's two parents that create the child.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any history at all.
Okay, so moving forward, assuming that she's got no family history and that she's had some cysts before, the cysts throughout the rest of the body don't necessarily correlate with what's going on in the breast. But that being said, what I will tell you is the majority of women, if you pulled 10 women off the street, 8 of them would have cysts. And they are completely benign. And what I often tell my patients is you wouldn't go plucking every gray hair from your head, hopefully. You would just leave it alone. The same thing if you were a brunette, don't go plucking every blonde hair from your head. It's just normal variant of either aging or of your, you know, situation. So we do have these normal but different things in our breasts, such as cysts, such as fibroadenomas. For your wife, if she hasn't had anything that's concerning, I would say if they're going to do something called an FNA, that's more likely, it's a fine needle aspirate, more likely they're just trying to get some cellular fluid to prove that it's benign. Sometimes what they'll do is if there's something showing up on the mammogram and then they do the ultrasound, it can be the cyst blocking an area, or they want to do a correlation and decompress the cyst and then look at the mammogram afterwards and say, hey, did that area resolve? Was it just the cyst pushing the tissue and creating this pseudo structure? So there's a lot of ways that doing a breast aspiration can be okay. For the most part, if it looks like a normal benign cyst, there's no changes on the mammogram, I'm not a big fan of aspirating cysts just for aspiration's sake. Once again, these are cell linings that are alive, and they'll just repair and recollect and refill. You really have to kind of tend to do several procedures and aspirations for them to be severely damaged enough in the cell wall to be collapsed. And once again, since it's a benign, for the most part, you don't even need to do that. So without seeing the films, it's kind of hard to say. It's less aggressive and less invasive than a core biopsy, which has a larger aperture. The core biopsies are the ones that tend to cause bleeding. The other thing is I would say look at the report and see if it says complex. That means that there's a solid component in the cyst. You know, there's quite a bit of information, and I'm kind of biting my tongue saying, do I say it? Do I not say it? I reread all my films as well as the reports because I tend to be pretty picky in terms of what I you know, want in my report. So what I would say to you is she's probably okay getting the aspiration. Does she need it without seeing her films? I'm not so sure.
It sounds like a second opinion on this wouldn't be a bad idea.
You know, my attitude is more data isn't going to hurt anyone. And, you know, every doc does things a little bit differently. But I think for you to get a second opinion, if she's really stressed out, even to have someone tee her up with, this is benign, but these are other things you can do. I know in my office, I tend to also look at other things, you know, that would put women at high risk and talk to them about preventative care management. So even if you're coming in about the question on that, I would always recommend, you know, prevention and exercise is a really powerful tool. And, you know, it's not just about being seen and you know, treat and street. You know, you're not going to need surgery, but I think it's also important to get the preventative care aspect to a patient as well. So I think that you wouldn't hurt yourself one iota taking her somewhere to get seen or to get a visit because information is so valuable.
Is your, I'm sorry, like I said, it didn't come in at the beginning of the show. Is your clinic here in town? Or
right, right. If you go to alaskapublic.org, you'll get a link to Alaska Surgical, the Alaska Institute of Surgical and Medical Specialties.
There. I'm laughing because okay. I can't even say the name
right.
of it.
And you got, you are okay. on the corner, you're between Benson and Northern Lights on, I can't remember, A Street.
188 West Northern Lights Boulevard. Yeah. I just say the Verizon building. You know, I'm new here, so yeah. I have to use my Google Maps to get there.
And then just one other question. I know I'm taking some time, but the procedure itself, is this a painful procedure or at least uncomfortable?
For the most part, it shouldn't be painful. They should use numbing medicine. They should localize a wheel of local anesthetic into the skin and then advance and give numbing medicine along the track. So it's not a major risk, and it's not majorly uncomfortable. But it once again, it's operator dependent. So the radiology group you go to can make your experience good or bad. For the most part, I found that in the community while I've been here, patients really have tolerated the biopsies well, and it hasn't been a bad situation. So it's not quite bad. It's very tolerable.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This is very comforting.
And remember, if she does have the biopsy, to all the women out there listening, you've ever had a biopsy, make sure you hold pressure. It's important.
Where the biopsy was done.
Yeah. Well, the key is actually not even at where the biopsy is done, but along the tract. So okay. People put their finger where the skin incision is. And remember, this can be traveling or traversing the entire breast.
Right.
So holding diffuse pressure on the breast can prevent a lot of hematomas.
A lot of, which is bleeding underneath the skin, which can cause some problems.
Yes.
Including infection.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Sure.
Ken, thanks for your call. Let's take advantage of Ken's call and ask a question in a way that he didn't ask it. What's the risk benefit of doing the biopsy?
Well, the thing is, and that's why we have these classifications. It's the way doctors and radiologists, breast surgeons talk to each other saying, this is suspicious. Right. A BI-RADS-3, we already discussed, is a 98% chance that it's nothing. So it's, 2% chance of malignancy. And that's why we're going to watch it. So if we have something that's a BI-RADS-4, it's saying that it's suspicious. And if you have a BI-RADS-4 and the rest of the impression supports that by looking at the body of the letter, because I've seen what looks like a BI-RADS-3 in the report, and then in the impression it comes back BI-RADS-4, meaning you're saying you're fine, and then in the biopsy they're recommending to do a procedure. So making sure that those two parts of the letter jive is important. But assuming that it is a BI-RADS-4, there's a very good likelihood that it could be malignant, and that does warrant a biopsy. And then there's 5, which is highly suspicious, which is pretty much we almost know that the way it's presenting on film is a cancer. We just now have to prove it.
All right. So we go ahead and do the biopsy. What are the risks of the biopsy?
So the biopsy, as stated earlier, can be quite traumatic if not done well and with post-procedural care. So the risk of the biopsy, as you had mentioned, are bleeding, which could lead to a hematoma. Blood is very rich in sugar and actually is the great medium for infections. So you can get a biopsy infection at the site. You can actually get sometimes skin breakdown, believe it or not, just from the tape that they use to close the biopsy incision. When you do a biopsy for something that's genuine, I always recommend a core, which is basically think of an apple core. It goes in there and takes a piece of tissue, a little tube of tissue that we can analyze, and it gives us much more information. I remember when I started my program out in New York and I was building this center and I was fighting with the radiology department saying, I don't want FNAs anymore. FNAs should only be done for cysts and aspirations of benign things or on a recurrent malignancy. When we need to know what's going on, a core will give us information regarding the receptor status, regarding the situation, is it invasive or is it contained? It gives me so much more data by doing that. In addition, we can also drop a clip so we know where we were and how to get back there. These are really critical parts.
Okay. Dr. Barbosa, I'm going to pretend I'm a woman now for a second. All right. I hear you. I'm 50 years old, but I'm not sleeping at night, and I have a 98% chance this is not a cancer, but I'm not going to be able to sleep. I'm anxious.
And you know what?
I got lots of anxiety.
Okay, I am a surgeon. I'm going to give full disclosure. I don't always advocate surgery. I do have a practice where when I started working in the community in New York that became known for, you don't have to have cancer to be seeing. And I think that's really important that women who have fear get it checked out in terms of talking to someone. As far as I'm concerned, if you're psychologically not sleeping and you're altering your daily activities, you have a problem. It's deforming. And there are women who are genuinely afraid. And my attitude is come, sit down, talk. You can get an appointment with any breast surgeon you like. If you can get an appointment, I know in New York was a problem. If you didn't need surgery, they didn't want to see you. But I think the really important thing is for that patient, it is really cancer until you tell her and show her. It's not, I always have patients bring their last couple of years of films. I don't just read the reports, I reread the films. And it's very empowering for patients to look at their ultrasound and go, oh, I see that. You see how it's wider rather than taller? I talk about the fat, jolly Saint Nick. If it grows right to left and is fat and happy, you're good. If it's the small, skinny, lesion that's vertically growing, think of Dudley Do-Right and that maniacal villain who was so pencil thin. And it's really very much a visual thing where women can look at these criteria and go, in 5 minutes, I understand why I'm okay.
But Dr. Barbosa, I hear all that. I understand what you're telling me, but I still think somebody ought to stick a needle in there and tell me for sure what's going on.
Well, you know what? All we could do is try to educate. Okay. And if the patient still has a fear or a concern about something that is benign.
Yep. Probably benign.
Most likely benign. It is something that I would advocate doing the biopsy because, once again, I believe in treating the psychological. And if she's going to lose sleep and not be functioning, it's just better for her to get confirmation.
Right. These are tough patients. And we all have them. That's where I was getting at. Sometimes, sometimes we just – that's all we can do.
Yeah. And like I said, if it changes their lifestyle and makes them more comfortable, I'm about it. But I definitely believe you should engage in the discussion if they don't need a procedure. And you can talk to any of my patients. If they haven't needed surgery, I talk them out of it. Yep. My joke is I drive a Mazda and I'm perfectly happy.
Sandy, you're on line one.
Hello?
Yeah. You still with us? I know you've been holding for a while. What can we do for you?
I'm 71 years old. At a recent annual checkup, a young intern doctor told me, you do not need mammograms anymore if you've not ever had an abnormal mammogram. I'm a little suspicious of this.
All right. Always good to ask questions.
Can I ask you, are you pretty active?
Yes, I am pretty active.
Are you the traditional Alaskan woman, as I find out, that does like 4,000 things and hikes up flat top?
No. Okay. No, I'm not. I spend the winters outside, and I bike and swim and walk.
So you're an athletic, outgoing woman. You're not in a nursing home. You're not, you know, with a peg tube, and you're not in a wheelchair.
No. I'm an active person. Yep.
Absolutely. So you're physiologically probably like the equivalent of some 50-year-olds in New York that are, you know, getting their elevator ride as exercise. So what I'm going to tell you is this, is if you're healthy and kicking, your prognosis and probability of living another 10 or 15 years is very good. The problem with breast cancer is, since it is a disease of aging, I would recommend that if you're a walkie-talkie with an active lifestyle and you're probably going to live a long time, there is a benefit to continue doing mammograms, because the breast tissue will be more easily interpreted on a mammogram, number one, so it's better for picking it up. And since it is a disease of aging, the longer you live, the more likely that there might be something. And that something that we find in your age bracket usually is more indolent and more easily treated. And it's something that if you get it early, early diagnosis and treatment does save lives. So I would say you're doing well, get your mammogram.
Yes, and that's what concerned me, because my mother-in-law and two other women I know did develop breast cancer in their 70s. So that was a concern to me.
Well, I've had patients who are in their 80s, adorable, walking, talking, fully active, fully mentating, and they've gotten their mammograms. And guess what? I think my patient is now currently 92. And we took out breast cancer, and it was a little bump in the road. We took care of it. It wasn't her issue. And at this point, she won't have an issue with it moving forward. So once again, I would recommend anyone who's in physically good shape and active, I expect that they're going to live a longer life. A mammogram is not going to hurt you.
Well, thank you very much. That's ease on my mind.
Okay. Have a good day,
Perfect.
Sandy. So this gets back to individual variation, individual decisions, individual recommendations versus guideline recommendations.
Yes.
And that's the point we want to keep
talking about. Once again, I did a national talk, and I had a young fellow get up to the mic and start, well, that's not what's in the guidelines. And I said, well, sad for you to go to a national conference to read what you could read online. And remember, implicit in the title, guidelines.
Right.
There is
something
that you get that is a recommendation, but if you're a tenured and seasoned physician, you really should know that not everything presents the way the textbook is, and therefore these guidelines may or may not be perfectly applicable. You have to have a low index of suspicion and sometimes think outside of the box to get a good treatment care.
We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and we still have a couple of emails that I have not gotten to, and we may not get there, but I think it's important that we bring up oncoplasty. I want you to describe that to me and tell us what that means for women who are approaching the situation where they're going to have some breast surgeries and what can be done to improve outcomes there.
Well, oncoplasty is actually a fusion of onco, as in cancer, Plasty being the surgical plastics reconstruction concept. And it's really a concept or an ideology of doing breast cancer surgery with attention to cosmesis and trying to maintain the woman's breast form. When I trained initially back at Sloan Kettering and back at some of these academic centers, it was, you have breast cancer, who cares what the patient looks like? We take out the cancer, big wax, big incisions, deforming situation. And then the attitude was just send them off to pathology, get the results. And then after that, you can send them to plastics. So it meant multiple surgeries and a lot of times involving a plastic surgeon, not at the same sitting, but later. Oncoplasty has moved that paradigm from the delayed reconstruction of any deficit to live and in the same time. So doing your removal of tumor as well as reconstructing the breast so that there isn't a deformity. And there's a whole scale on that. But there are a lot of pros and cons that people would argue. The one pro of oncoplasty is a lot of women are not left with a deformity. And now with our ability to evaluate tumors intraoperatively, I think that we're getting better and better. Once again, a patient does have to understand that if you're rearranging tissue, you might need to go back if the margin's on final chemical analysis, because once again, I stress to patients, you can't feel cancer, nor do you want to cut through it and feel it. So a lot of it is left up to the staining. Some people think that, oh, can't you feel the tumor? I was like, well, yeah, you can feel it, but you want to leave what I describe as normal tissue around it. And in that normal tissue might be microscopic or even less than microscopic, but more diagnostic tissue that has to be stained to be seen. You can't see it under a microscope. You're just waiting for the receptor staining.
All right. I miscalculated on the time we have left because we started 3 minutes late. So we're really in our last three minutes.
So there's much more to say.
Yeah. I'm going to just ask you to sum up with two questions. You can address them either one you want. What's the most common mistakes you wish patients didn't make? But then also leave us with one or two or three maybe really important things that we want to take away from the program today.
The most important thing that I find is that women tend to feel like they have to get the breast surgery right away. And I always caution them to slow down and realize that if you spend more time researching your car than taking care of your health, that's probably a problem. So understanding that these things usually, for the most part, grow slowly and you have time to do a full workup, because your first trip to the OR, if it's planned well, should hopefully be your last. In terms of take-home messages, I think we started and alluded on is speaking to exercise as a preventative measure. It's very important that women understand that weight can be a risk factor in and of itself, in addition to aging, and that exercise, 4 hours of cardiovascular per week, can reduce your risk by as much as 30% to 40%. That's standard, and then you can look at some of the websites. There's other studies. Then I do what's called Barbosaism. I Barbosaize a patient's care, and I explain to them that by weightlifting, you can increase your muscle mass. In doing so, you're actually revving your metabolism while you sleep as well as while you're exercising. So you get double the bang for the buck. And yes, that is the secret why the guy next to you can have the ho-ho and the beer and you get to look at him and get fat, because he carries more muscle mass. So if women do that, not only does it lower your risk for breast cancer, but it also sets you up for increasing your bone density. And then I always recommend exercise, something that is going to be complementary, yoga or stretching for the mind-body experience, stress reduction also being important. That, too, has not been vetted. That is a Barbosaism. Wait 10 years, that'll get validated just like the exercise did.
So exercise and weight loss are probably the two most important, most well-documented ways to decrease your risk is what I'm hearing you say.
True that.
Okay. Wow. I'm out of breath. Thanks very much.
And I feel like we just started. I'm like, when are we going to start the interview? There's so much more.
My thanks to today's guest, Anchorage breast surgeon, Dr. Karen Barbosa. If you'd like to continue the conversation on surgical disorders of the breast, you can join KSKA on Facebook. How do you do that? Well, you can find our link and our archives at www.alaskapublic.org. And by the way, just take the time at that same website and let us know your thoughts and suggestions. And you can do that at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, perhaps a little slower pace, Prentice Bimperton's going to be the host, and he's discussing the merits of wilderness-based therapy as a treatment for behaviorally challenged teens, let's say. Experts from the Alaska Crossings Program in Wrangell, Alaska will be joining him. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, October 27th. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki put up with today's program and web edited us today. And she also is our audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.